Hello.
Welcome, everybody. I think I seen you around before previous lectures. Well, my name is Wojciech Siemaszkiewicz, and I co-curator of the exhibition on graphic moderns that you can see in the Wokenheim Gallery. And today I would like to welcome you to a lecture by Professor David Goldfarb, who has been teaching Eastern European literature in general and Polish in particular for many years, last 10 years at Barnard College at Columbia University, and this year at Freie Universität in Berlin. Please.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming out on a cold day in the afternoon to hear about Polish avant-gardism. So the title of my talk is Zdrój, which is the title of a journal that you can see in the exhibition here, which means the source, or the spring, Polish expressionism from the source. And this is a cover that was reproduced many times in the journal. So I'm going to start with an epigraph from Stanisław Przybyszewski, Polish expressionist novelist and theorist, from his novel Homo Sapiens. Did you ever see the cry of heaven? No? Well, let me tell you, I did. I saw heaven crying. It seemed as if the whole sky opened its thousands of mouths and hurled down molten colors into space. The whole sky, an endless expanse of stripes ranging in color from dark red to black, congealed blood. No, a pool reflecting a purple sunset and then dirty gold. Ugly, disgusting, but superb. My God, how superb! Then transports of joy. I grew, mounted up to the sky, so that I could have lighted a cigarette with the sun. This vision of the cry of heaven is recounted by the character Mikita, the painter character in Przybyszewski's novella Overboard, which is the first part of the Homo Sapiens trilogy. Unmistakably, it describes one of the most widely recognized and popular paintings in modern history, Edvard Munch's The Cry from 1893. Let's go to the next picture. This is a portrait of Przybyszewski himself by Edvard Munch. And of course, well, this is probably something you haven't seen, but you know, since we're talking about this is something you've all seen. Przybyszewski, Munch, and August Strindberg were friends together in Berlin during the 1890s at the cafe that Strindberg named the Black Piglet. They figure into each other's works in very important and interesting ways. The characters in Homo Sapiens are loosely based on the denizens of the Schwarze Ferkel, the Black Piglet. Munch painted both Strindberg and Przybyszewski, as you saw on the previous slide. All were smitten by a woman who would become Przybyszewski's wife, Dagny Uhel. Przybyszewski edited the first critical study of Munch's work, and Munch changed his explanations of his own work in accord with Przybyszewski's readings. Munch even accepted Przybyszewski's suggestion that he change the title of the last of a series of paintings called Despair to Der Schrei. So that's not Munch's title, that's Przybyszewski's title. Somehow, this Norwegian painter, Polish critic, and Swedish dramatist managed in Berlin to found what is largely regarded today as a nationalistic movement in German art, but which had a wide currency throughout Northern and Central Europe, namely Expressionism, of course, in ways largely unrecognized outside the region. The cry, or the scream, became a central icon in Expressionism for the non-representational sign. Munch's painting was not meant to really portray a person screaming, I think, but to be a scream itself. Like Mikita's scream in Przybyszewski's novel, the purpose of the new art was not to represent an emotional state as an intentional referent, but to be the unintentional sign of the internal state and animal desire of the artist, like the reflex of protecting the eyes from danger. As such, the expressionists sought to subvert the very purpose of painting and language as media of representation by producing work as an autonomic response to pure subjective states, or so they imagined, or so they strove to do. Przybyszewski's description of Munch's painting inverts the figure in the ground, illustrating perhaps what is most interesting and distinctive in the cry. For Przybyszewski, it is not the cry of the individual on the endlessly receding road, but the cry of heaven in which this person has become immersed. It could be that Przybyszewski is putting Makita, the speaker in the epigraph, into the scene as a man on the road, relevant to our other exhibition going on here next door. Though no other person is named in Makita's vision, the colors match Munch's dramatic sunset at Oslofjord, and the reference to the cry seems hard to misplace. Makita may also have been retelling Munch's own story of a drunken hallucination, which Munch scholars take as his inspiration for the painting. In the painting, bands of color seem to emanate like sound from the mouth of the figure. But the wave-like body has also become the sound. Munch wrote under his lithograph of the cry, "Ich fühlte das große Geschrei durch die Natur." I felt the great cry through nature. The cry does not come from the person on the road so much, but flows through him. There is no frame dividing the internal state of the subject and the figure from the world. What else could the cry of heaven be but the cry of the subject? If the painting succeeds, it does so by extending the waves of the cry beyond the frame of the image into the consciousness of the spectator, namely us. In Polish Expressionism's late phase, Przybyszewski published several manifesti and discourses on aesthetics in the journals Drój, The Source. The leading and most radical exponent of Polish Expressionism from 1917 to 1922, after the demise of the Krakow journal Życie, where Przybyszewski had published his first Polish works in 1898, and Zenon Przesmyski's Chimera, which I think we have a few copies of here in the collection as well, published in Warsaw from 1901 to 1907. Published in Poznań, Zdrój was somewhat closer to journals like Die Aktion and Der Sturm, which were foci of artistic production for the Berlin Expressionists. Der Sturm, according to its editor-in-chief, was, quote, "a journal, an exhibition, a publishing house, an art school, a stage, but that doesn't cover it." And the pages of Zdrój, I think, reflect this model. They published other books, they had exhibitions, there were other events around the journal. We're very fortunate to have an almost complete run of the journal here in the Slavic and Baltic division at the NYPL, missing only a few pages here and there, and the first volume, which was a rarity even when the journal was in print. The editors published an announcement in one of the later issues asking if any of the readers had the first issue because they didn't have a copy themselves. I've seen pictures of it, so I know it exists in one or two libraries in Poland, but I haven't held the first issue in my hand. In addition to Przybyszewski's manifesti and rants, really, the journal published works by authors as eclectic as the romantic poet Juliusz Słowacki, the novelist Vaclav Berendt, Julian Tuwim, the poet, Oskar Miłosz, who was a relative of Czesław Miłosz and was also a poet who inspired the Nobel Prize-winning poet to become a poet himself, Jarosław Iwaszkiewicz, another important writer, Józef Witlin, at that time mainly a poet, later known as a novelist. I'll get back to him later. They published a translation of Rabindranath Tagore in Serial by Jan Kasparowicz, who was also an important modernist writer, as well as a regular series of poems and translations by Miriam or Zenon Przesmyski, including verses by Apollinaire, Swinburne, Keats, Kipling, and others. So it was also a vehicle to bring West European modernism into Poland, and symbolism especially. The chief editor and founder, Jerzy Hulewicz, who lived from 1886 to 1941, and others in his workshop regularly provided illustrations and graphic works that stood on their own, including lithographs, woodcuts, and even there were tipped-in halftone photographs of sculpture, and occasionally a color cover. We have, I think, two of them, and I think that's probably, maybe there's a third displayed here in the exhibition, which is called Graphic Modernism from the Baltic to the Balkans, 1910 to 1935, as I'm sure most of you know. When I first began looking at the journal as a graduate student in comparative literature at CUNY, when they used to be right across the street, about 15 years ago, it had been sitting more or less untouched for many years in the library annex, where paper copies of old newspapers and journals are stored. In Poland, modernist rarities such as this would be very much in demand and would not be easy to access. During the last years of communism, or 87 and 89, I sat in on classes on modernism at the Institute of Polish Philology, as it was then called. Now it's called the Institute of Polish Studies, Instytut Polonistyki, at the Jagiellonian University in Kraków. And many important works from this, from the modernist period, from the avant-garde period, had not been reprinted since the war. So usually the system was that maybe three students would, have access to the one copy in the Institute's library, and they would all, read it and then report back to the other students about, what the text was about. And I presume the other students hoped that it didn't show up on an exam later in their career if they couldn't, access it. But that's how hard it was at that time to even get the most important novels from that period, and a journal like this would be really a special thing. So here in New York, since this was just sitting in the annex, I didn't have very much competition for these materials, so long as I could identify them in the catalog, which wasn't always so easy, since some of these books were cataloged during periods when there may not have been somebody who knew what they were or who could read Polish. But on the other hand, that provided many opportunities for serendipitous discoveries in the collection. I had access to original prints of books from the modernist and interwar periods in the Slavic and Baltic division anytime I needed them. Not too many other people were looking for the things I was looking for, and I'm very pleased to see that this journal has made the journey from the annex to the main collection and now in a special exhibition. So to return to the topic at hand, certain works from this stage of expressionism take the cry, this image from Munch, as a theme. Rather than attempting to reproduce a cry or to produce a cry in poetry, for instance, the cry becomes a symbol in works like this poetic manifesto by the artist-poet Stanisław Kubicki, who lived from 1899 to 1943. Let's get another slide here. This is a portrait of Kubicki by Jerzy Hulewicz in woodcut. Hulewicz was the editor of the journal for those who came in late. I guess I'll just read it in my translation. So the poem is the cry, "Oh, aching weakness! Day by day, a little decline into the wasted confinement of words. I shatter and collapse. I like to howl what's in me, but I choke on your language. Every word hurts me. I slept hard. Why would I be awakened, a fossil in speech? I fling myself and howl. I strike at the defiant gates with silence and leave behind only bloody tracks. Life is a black wedding. Oh, blessed is the cry of the overman." Well, originally, I was looking at expressionism, from the point of view of unmediated expression of emotion, and I would say that there's not very much unmediated expression in this particular example. Kubicki says he would like to howl, but he doesn't, The poem lands on a reference that can only be mediated by Nietzsche, right, of the Übermensch, the overman. Hardly an animal state that Przybyszewski talks about. On the other hand, we might give credit to precocious youth. Kubicki would have only been 19 when his poem was published. And we might recognize, as the poem suggests, in the manner of a manifesto, what the ideal work would be. A manifesto being something in between an interesting work of art and a description of how to make one. A work without words in which silence and bloody traces are the unintended signifiers of the speaker's pain. The overman, then, das Übermensch, is one who exists in a state of true authenticity. The will to power for this author might be said to exist in the propensity for transparent expression of internal states without the intervening mediation of language or other forms of socialization. Kubicki's poem is symptomatic of the popular and maybe vulgar reading of Munch's painting. The screaming figure is the subject and the source of the cry. For Kubicki, and probably for most viewers of the painting, Munch's open-mouthed figure, head held in despair, is a representation of the internal state of the picture itself, rather than an evocation, say, of the mood or stemning Munch describes as the subject of his paintings. The mood is a product of the intense reds, blues, the streak of gold, and the waving lines and curving shapes against the relentless perspective of the road, rather than the events that are incidentally used to convey the mood. the person portrayed in the image is not so significant as the person's unity with nature. On the other hand, this sort of youthful exuberance is precisely the reason to look at journals like Zdrój, to get a feel for the vibrancy, community, and contentiousness of modernism that is often filtered out of histories that periodize and divide artists and writers into neatly organized movements and groups. The expressionists associated with Zdrój, for instance, might be seen as in opposition to the more neoclassicist journal Scamander. And indeed, there is a negative review of Scamander that appears in the March 1920 issue of Zdrój. On the other hand, Julian Tuwim, who was very much involved with Scamander, in fact published occasionally in Zdrój. And as did the poet and editor of the other competing journal of avant-gardism, Chimera, Zenon Przesmitski, Miriam, of course, he was translating in Zdrój, suggesting that the borders between these literary groupings and might be more porous than it would seem from the general histories of Polish literature. And I think this is true of any national literature in any period. We, you know, sort of scholars want to, you know, make groups and, you know, divide things up, but then when you look at the journals, everything's a jumble. And sometimes the jumble is more interesting, I think, than the neat codified image and periodized, you know, vision that we have of these movements. To give a concrete example of the importance of looking at the original journal, I published an essay on a poem of Józef Witlin in his poem called Hymn of Hatred, which first appeared in Zdrój in 1919, and as far as I know, had not been at that time reprinted since 1929 in the third edition of Witlin's Hymns, nor had it been translated into English. Witlin, whom I've mentioned before, is more well known for his pacifist novel about an infantryman in World War I, Salt of the Earth, published in 1936, which has been translated into over 30 languages. And among Poles, Witlin is well known for his broadcast from America on Radio Free Europe. He lived in New York for many years. But before Salt of the Earth, he frequently published in Zdrój and was at times part of the editorial staff. Witlin's poems in Zdrój are often quite different from the later versions of the same works, particularly in their punctuation, but also in their diction, and there are cases where entire stanzas have been excised. The versions in Zdrój have a raw and immediate quality. In Zdrój, he might have used, say, three dashes to indicate a pause, which is almost a hallmark of an immature poet. And I would use immature in the highest sense of, you know, Witold Kumprowicz used immature to, you know, suggest, you know, the raw, pure self. And then later he would change that to a simple period because that was more refined. Or he might have used a common word in the original version like górny, which means high, you know, as being on a mountaintop. And then later he would change it to sztitny, which means more like sublime, on the summit, perhaps indicating a subtle leaning from the expressionist mystic mountain to the neoclassical sense, the acme of the Scamander group. But it's important to know where it started and where it ended. When I submitted my essay for publication in a volume on Witlin that was published in Poland with a Polish and an American editor, the Polish editor thought that I must have been insane because he had never seen this version of the poem and had consulted the version published in the first edition of Witlin's poems published in 1920, which was widely considered to be the original source. And perhaps that revised version of 1920 represented the poet's completed vision, but expressionism being about the immediate and the raw and the unedited, or at least the less edited, version, that's what we find in Zdrój in 1919. And that's, you know, one of the reasons that I think it's so important to really look at these things, even though they might be collected later. Just go back to the source, as it were, and you might find something nobody's looked at, even experts on that subject. One other representation of the theme of the cry that captures, I think, the extreme subjectivism of the gesture, of the cry of the self, with greater complexity, perhaps, than Kubicki in his poem, is a woodcut by Władysław Skotarek, called Okrzyk, or The Outcry, which appears in Zdrój in 1919. In this version, there is no landscape. It's completely outside the frame. And we see only the face with its open mouth and the familiar gesture of the hands that we would recognize as how we cry out. Skotarek, however, adds the element of vision. Beams radiate up from the screaming figure's eyes like searchlights, seeking a response from the heavens. While the despairing figure that we recognize from Munch may have become something of a cliché by the end of the First World War, as in a Jerzy Hulewicz woodcut of March 1918, and the Nietzschean theme of the overman emerging strong-willed and uncorrupted from nature, as portrayed by Janusz Wroniewski on the cover of the story for several issues, one of which can be seen in the exhibition. That's one of the library slides. There were images that also succeeded, I think, in achieving the effect that Munch was trying to achieve. The most interesting one is this, I think. Arthur Świnarski's image, The Drunk, which presents a face surrounded by concentric circles formed by street lamps and by buildings collapsing on the central figure. The head has lost its own boundaries, and no line differentiates between the curving edifices and the consciousness of the drunk. And I think that's also what's true of Munch's painting, that there isn't a line between the self and nature. The individual surroundings are extensions of the mind. Another fine image, I think, is Władysław Skotarek's Panic, which similarly shows three open-mouthed figures running on a cobblestone street, waving their arms, one grabbing his head in a gesture named by the title, but the city is also in panic. Everything is in panic. Przybyszewski makes a gesture like this in his novella Overboard when Falk, the main character, falls in love with Isa and recognizes another character, a female character, that he is in competition with his friend Makita, whose quote I read at the beginning. His repeated thought is, run, run, the fundamental animal instincts symbolized in another scene by a bloody fight between two elk for dominance of the herd in the novel. Our perspective in Panic, this image, is such that all lines radiate from a central point, as if the city were exploding. The panic of the running figures is the panic of their surroundings. The panic city is the consciousness of the panic city. So there's the city, and there's no separation between the city and the consciousness of the city. Świnarski's version of the cry, this is also entitled The Cry, Krzyk, is dedicated to Przybyszewski, suggesting that it follows his novel more than the Munch painting. Though Munch's sky is preserved, this image of the setting sun and these radiating lines, in Przybyszewski's Krzyk, the cry of the street is a repeated motif, and it does seem as if Świnarski's cry issues from a mouth on the street, radiating out through the buildings. The mouth appears so far forward in the space of the image that it could also be the mouth of the viewer shouting into the street. Rather than standing off to the side looking laterally, as we are in Munch's painting The Cry, we are staring straight down the road into nowhere, relocated to the city rather than the fjord. The Drunk, Panic, Przybyszewski's Homo sapiens, and Munch's The Cry convey the boundlessness of the consciousness in the state of pain. Genuine immediate pain, fear, panic, despair, and even intoxication pervade every other element of consciousness. The impulse of expressionism to relate this sense of the consciousness of pain is like the impulse of Dostoevsky's underground man beset with a toothache, whose moans express, quote, all the aimlessness of the pain which consciousness finds so humiliating, the whole system of natural laws about which you don't really give a damn, but as a result of which you're suffering nonetheless, while nature isn't suffering. In the condition of having a toothache, the world becomes a toothache. The expressionist work is less a representation than a gesture or a kind of performance. In Przybyszewski's essay Obrachunki, which means something like reckonings, this is the as it appeared in the journal, published in the second and third issues of Zdrój in January of 1918, Przybyszewski defined the critical concept most frequently associated with his work, the sphere of the naked soul. As, quote, the soul that is the presence of incomplete beings before my being and of beings longed for after my own. In other words, the naked soul is eternity encompassed in the present moment, or what I would call a kind of absolute presence. The purely subjective moods the expressionists were trying to capture are unrepresentable, even in memory. While we can remember having pain, we cannot recall pain as pain without creating a new pain. Therefore, absolute presence is the temporal frame of pain. The immense challenge of expressionism is to make as art what cannot even be represented by the self to the self. I'll let the other images just run in the background. Representational content becomes a concession that the artist or poet makes, a sacrifice through which the subjectivity of the artist might be felt. As Jan Stor explains in another manifesto, a later one called Chego Chemi, which was published as an editorial signed by the editors in Zdruy in 1920, Stor writes, "We wish to give the truest, the most powerful, the most immediate statement of the naked spirit, and thus the spirit admittedly concealing itself as such in manifestations of life, but not figured out with the help of their appearance, confrontation, and changing motion. The content of the expressionist work is not what it means, but how it feels. Words, lines, and colors are not signs with reference, but media of performance, through which a unity between the feeling of the artist and the feeling of the spectator or hearer is established." Julian Tuwim, whom I mentioned earlier, Tuwim lived from 1893 to 1954, and the poets around the journal Scamander were occasionally criticized by the editors of Zdruy for their devotion to classical forms. But Tuwim had his expressionist moments, particularly in later works like his famous poem Balvo Peja, The Ball at the Opera, or The Opera Ball as it's translated often. In 1920, he published his own version of The Cry in the journal Kurier Polski, the Polish Courier, and it's titled The Cry, Chick, again. I'll read it in translation. "I don't know how it was, whether in the flicker of candles half-lit or in the murk around the horror of rigid naked walls, but an ominous sky hung over the city, ripped, gushed over as the blood of murderous mourns, the steel clatter beat on the tramway rails, wheels, the racket of hooves clopped on the walk, and 2 million people moved through the streets, as if a crowd shot from the barrel of every alleyway, and sharp white beams nervously flickered in burning filaments, in the frosted bulbs of lamps, directions tangled both whirl and traffic signals like a film, scanned at the breathtaking tempo of the city's iamb. Oh, where did you get lost in this throng, in this babble? On which streets and in which clothes did you walk? All these strange faces have pursued you with their eyes, and I, distant your weeping lackey, all these strange faces have pursued you with their eyes, cried out to you, don't go, cried out to you, no, the city forged an alliance between a funny boy far away and thrashed by a shriek, a crash, a blast, your steps. You walked, so young, golden, undulating. In the evening, you melted the violet gaze of dread. A hot frenzy seethed the city, seething. And space howled in pain, rent by your step till it bled. Like the thought of velvet, like the shadow of a silken cloth, you floated unminding. In a step, your step vanished, and something just rang out ever more sadly. From so far, from afar, rang out my holy cry." Tuwim's poem follows a regular, in the original, alternating rhyme scheme in each four-line stanza, and the line is a fairly consistent trochaic hexameter with a caesura after the third beat, with the occasional amphibrach created by the addition of a weak syllable at the beginning of the half line. In other words, this is a poem that follows classical forms and regular meter. Some of the more radical expressionist poets might have rejected Tuwim's formalism because rhyme and meter are signs of constructiveness, while free verse presents at least the illusion of immediacy. But I think Tuwim's poem demonstrates that they need not have been at odds, and perhaps weren't. Just as Munch's work aspired to the condition of music, to borrow a phrase from Walter Pater, in its representation of mood through intense color and strong fantastical compositional elements, Tuwim's meter can achieve a comparable effect. By 1920, however, Zdruy takes a new turn, marked by its new manifesto, mentioned above, What We Want, Jacob Semi, published in the March issue of 1920. Here are some excerpts. What we want, they're regrouping. They say, at a moment when young Polish artistic production begins to differentiate itself and in certain of its expressions to outline distinctions of conceptual contours, we acknowledge as good for the continuation of the first period of Zdrój, the expression of which was the entrance of creative thought from one generation to a second, to close that second period, the reflection of which was a struggle of thought of the young adepts of art, with a capital A, on the cohesiveness of their conceptual direction. So you can see how much, these very young writers, they're in their teens. I mean, Wittgenstein, I don't think, had been barely turned 20 by the time, he was publishing in Zdrój, probably before he was 20. And they're, constantly redefining themselves and trying to do so formally in the journal. So they write, Hulewicz and the other editors, presently a crystallization of directions, if not a mutual crossing of them, is occurring. The strength of the creation of poets and of visual artists, of whom Zdrój has been above all a spokesman despite deviations, have grown, acknowledging their inconsistency as if there could be any kind of consistency in an artistic journal, having grown to such a level that serving the exclusiveness of this organ as it wants to be our publication, right? I mean, is there anything like this now where, people are publishing a journal or even a website or something like that where they feel they have such an important mission? And that's, one of the exciting things to sort of see. And I mean, it sounds bombastic to us, in a sense, but that's one of the exciting things, I think, to see in this journal. That they were completely present in this project. For this current volume, we open a third period in the development of Zdrój. From now on, the readers of our publication will meet with works tending exclusively toward internal values flowing from the source outlined in the programmatic words below. New thought has matured. A spiritual convergence of persons related to each other has united. Works mutually complementing each other strongly, distinctly in their exclusivity, that which was previously most essential in the errant and searching spirit, stands in the vicissitudes of consciousness. May you, who feel and grasp us as able, run with us toward the known, which is contained in the unknown, and has kindled the longing of ages. And here are a few excerpts from their four credos in this manifesto, What We Want. Credo 1. Each work giving perfect expression to one aim or to the aims of many of its epoch is always a work of eternal value. Credo 2. Bergson states in his Introduction to Metaphysics that only by intuition may we penetrate the core of a given thing and only in this manner apprehend its essence. I'll come back to all of these in a moment. Credo 3, which I've mentioned above, but here it is in context. We wish to give the truest, the most powerful, and the most immediate statement of the naked spirit, and thus the spirit admittedly concealing itself as such in manifestations of life, but not figured out with the help of their appearance, confrontation, or changing motion. Credo 4. No, we do not want to be poets looking at life through a prism of aesthetic fantasy, who seek themes lending themselves to literature, for whom such themes are a pretext of form rather than intuition, heard in the sound of an artist's alpha and omega. We strive to be people who harness the current moving through the current, who harness the current, thank you, moving through the reality of events, who are caused pain by humanity, rolling down in the embrace of disgrace and despoilment, the nation subjugated, the worker hungry, woman unliberated. So that's interesting, right? 1920, they have a vision of women's liberation. The first credo reflects a tendency in Scamander to strive for the eternal, but to see it in the expressionist way as reflected in the moment, and recognizes that the moment is all an artist has access to, right? By comparison, I mean, one of the sort of neoclassical poems that appears in Scamander is a poem by the poet Mieczysław Jastrun, who says, the concluding line of one of his poems, all I see is this roadside weed, right? I mean, everything is contained in just one little thing in nature. But here there's a kind of, there's the urban, you know, urban life. There's there are social problems, and that thing that happens in the moment is the source of, you know, of the eternal. The acknowledgement of a Bergsonian conception of intuition in the second credo formalizes the impulse of expressionism to value the unmediated expression of the artist's internal state, which is where we started from. The third credo regroups under Przybyszewski's rubric, identifying the naked soul or the naked spirit, and often, you know, it's interesting how this term sort of took on a life of its own. I mean, people were using the words, the phrase naked spirit or naked soul. Critics were using it perhaps even before Przybyszewski was. I mean, he was using the term naked, and he was using the term spirit, but it wasn't, I mean, there's an essay, a point at which he recognizes that other people have ascribed this idea to him. He says, yes, that's a good idea. So he starts using it himself. And you can see that in, you know, some of his manifesti that appear in Zdrój. The third and fourth credos mark the place of social reality in the expressionist worldview. And we can see that in the images we've been looking at, images of drunks on the street and things like that. While the neoclassical vision was the eternal, rooted in eternal themes and myth and so forth, Scamander, right, being one of them, itself, the expressionist vision saw the eternal in the extreme conditions of everyday existence, war, poverty, and subjugation. By 1920, perhaps Tuvim, in the poem that I just read, who might be seen as vacillating between neoclassicism and expressionism, can take a more ironic perspective on the cry. The poem begins with an invocation of Munch's bloody sky in the expressionist image of masses, machines, and the city, which is a more alliterative expression in Polish, masa, maszyna, miasto. The speaker is reflecting on naive youth, and the krzyk, the cry of the poem, is locked in that temporal framework. Like one who tries to remember pain, Tuvim is only remembering the fact of despair and not despair, the representation of despair, rather than despair itself. From the first flickering light to the close of the velvet curtain casting a shadow on the silken screen, we are cued to the fact that in Tuvim's poem we're watching a film. Ti, you, is an abstract female object of desire, who is the addressee of many of the poems of his collection, Shudma Yeshin, The Seventh Autumn, and is now incarnated as a glamorous foreign movie star. The cries of the audience are responses to a double exclamation point melodrama, a manufactured despair rather than an authentic cry to the naked soul. When Tuvim tries to represent the cry from an objective distance, the despair that seems so authentic in Munch is rendered false for the moment. The film is all just a sham. Unable to recall the pain as pain, Tuvim can laugh and wonder what all the fuss was about. On the other hand, perhaps Tuvim is attempting to convey a new emotion within the aesthetic of expressionism, embarrassment at one's own youth. Maybe that's what, you know, what Wietling was doing when he was revising his poems. From the perspective of maturity, this poem, with its tangled images of entanglement, attempts to create a new kind of emotion in the reader, the shock of recognition. The shame of having been led into despair by a representation of despair seems greater at a distance than false despair itself. If pain cannot be remembered or represented as pain to the self, then perhaps the strongest feeling that can be salvaged from it is the feeling of irony. And with the rise of irony, later to become the total content of postmodern art, expressionism degenerates from a philosophy into a style. Thank you. If there are questions, I'll do my best to answer them. Yes? The readership of Zdrój. I can't tell you how many they published. I don't know that. But who was, you know, one question is who was reading these, you know, other than, you know, other, you know, poets and authors of journals. Well, they certainly were. You can find, if you look at other journals of the period, they're all reviewing each other. So there seemed to be, you know, there were, you know, dedicated communities, you know, sort of around various artistic groups. There was, you know, there was the group in Poznan around Zdrój. There was a Lithuanian group that Miłosz eventually was part of that published a journal that's called The Switch. There was the group around Chimera. There was a group around around Skamander. There were, you know, several other, you know, journals like this. And there was there was a cafe life. So those people are certainly interested in this kind of material. You know, much like there was in Berlin and in Vienna. Some of it involved very sort of interesting cabaret in Kraków. The most well known of these was a group called the Green Balloon, and they had regular and well attended performances. That are sort of recorded as sort of an important moment in the history of Polish theater. So there's a lot of overlap in the arts. I mean, one thing sort of to understand what's going on in Poland in the in the teens and 20s, and I think this is true of actually many of the sort of East European cities, is this kind of overlapping. Of the visual arts, of poetry, of the writing of manifesti and philosophy. There are figures like in the interwar period. I work somewhat more on the interwar period than on this earlier earlier period. But there are figures like Stanisław Ignatievicz, who is a poet and a painter and a novelist. Not too much poetry, one or two things, but a photographer, a dramatist. He's doing everything, and people around his circle. I mean, there's Leon Chwistek, who was a mathematician and a philosopher of science and a cubist painter, right? I mean, that was sort of the normal kind of, that was just sort of the state. People, I don't think, there was, an idea of being an artist, I think. And I think we forget that sometimes. I mean, to, look at, we can look at, sort of the Czech situation, too. I often teach courses in literary theory, and we look at, works by Roman Jakobson, and I like, bringing in, the famous linguist and, the founder of Russian formalism and Czech structuralism and and all these important movements in linguistics. But I think often Americans and in general people don't realize what a sense of humor he had, and how close he was to poets and writers like Mayakovsky and like Karol Taiga and people like that, and how he tried to write his own transrational poetry and did. And there's this wonderful collection. Jakobson's Petersburg. It's called My Petersburg Years, I think. Of his poems, which no one looks at. And because maybe as poems they're not so important, but in terms of understanding the period, and really the ferment that was going on, and how there was sort of all this overlap between intellectual life, academic life, and the arts. That's where it comes out. In the journals like this, I mean, that's where you see it. I mean, you see this kind of, overlap. So, I would, the readership, it was this sort of very diverse community of people doing all sorts of things. That's not, maybe a specific answer, but it's hard to find a specific answer to that.
Is this translated into other languages?
No. The journal wasn't translated into other languages, although things were translated from other languages into Polish in the journal. However, Przybyszewski published, the novel that I mentioned, the trilogy Homo Sapiens, he first published in German before he published it in Polish. It was translated into English in the teens or 20s, remarkably. And also into Russian and to other languages. I mean, Przybyszewski is interesting, this fascinating figure who, sort of, there's a, really, before the war, if you look at, sort of, dissertations on Polish literature, and scholarship on Polish literature in the United States. There's probably more on Przybyszewski than any other author, which is, you know, it's very peculiar because, you know, people today, I mean, do they, unless they're specialists in, you know, in expressionism, aren't likely to, you know, sort of even recognize the name. They might recognize the name of his daughter Stanisława Przybyszewska, who was the author of Danton, which became, you know, sort of an important film. And also another work on the French Revolution, title of which has just slipped out of my mind. But in any case, certain things existed in multiple languages, but the journal itself wasn't, you know, per se translated into other languages. For a period of time, it was published in Vienna, so it, you know, it seems to have existed in more than one place. Printed in Vienna.
Did they have something current going on like this, or that's it?
Well, I mean, there's a question. I mean, this, you know, the sort of the avant-garde, you know, modernist journal was a thing of its age, you know, and is there something like that? Well, there are chapbooks in poetry, you know. I mean, that's something that's happening. There's a lot of new publishing in Eastern Europe, you know, sort of in the wake of, after communism. I mean, there are all these small presses that have, you know, established themselves and that are publishing interesting work of younger poets and so forth. So you do see that. I mean, there are journals that have their own kind of interesting livelihood that have come out of certain, you know, sort of social moments. I mean, one that I can think of in Poland, which is a journal that, you know, that we can find here or in many academic libraries, Nagłos, or Out Loud, which came out of the phenomenon of during martial law in the Solidarity years, when many things were forbidden. It was, you know, anything that was, you know, sort of politically challenging was not permitted. This group of intellectuals around Jerzy Ilg decided that, well, if we can't publish a journal, we'll have a performance, and we'll just read it out loud. So the authors will all come to an auditorium, and they will all read out loud the articles that they would publish in a journal if we could publish a journal. And they continued that, and, you know, it continues to this day, and it has this, it tries to maintain this feeling of a sort of academic journal that's a little more lively than you know, something, you know, that, you know, like, PMLA or, you know, something, you know, to give it an example of an American journal, where there's usually a picture of the author and there's a signature of the author with each article, and things are a little less formal than they otherwise might be. So there's, you know, there are things like that, but, you know, other things are taking the place of this. I mean, you know, probably, you know, blogs and websites are much easier if you're a starving artist to establish than a journal. So I suppose that's where, you know, I would look if I wanted to find a contemporary example of this kind of phenomenon. But it also, you know, required a certain kind of idealism, you know, a belief that, you know, you could have an artistic mission. Do we have that anymore? I don't know. Thank you.